Johann Wolfgang von Goethe was a German poet, playwright, novelist, scientist, and statesman, widely regarded as the greatest and most influential writer in the German language. American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson selected Goethe as one of six representative men, along with Plato, Napoleon, and Shakespeare. Goethe's work had a profound and wide-ranging influence on Western literacy, politics, and philosophical thought from the 18th century to the present day. His poems were set to music by many composers, including Mozart, Beethoven, and Wagner. And I'd like to start off today by reciting his poem called The King of Thule, written in 1774 by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. There was a king in Thule, was faithful till the grave. To whom his mistress, dying, a golden goblet gave. Not was to him more precious. He drained it at every bout. His eyes with tears ran over, as oft he drank thereout. When came his time of dying, the towns in his land he told. Not else to his heir denying, except the goblet of gold. He sat at the royal banquet with his knights of high degree. In the lofty hall of his fathers, in the castle by the sea. There stood the old carouser and drank the last life glow. And hurled the hallowed goblet into the tide below. He saw it plunging and filling and sinking deep in the sea. Then fell his eyelids forever, and nevermore drank he. Goethe was a free thinker who believed that one could be inwardly Christian without following any of the Christian churches, many of whose central teachings he firmly opposed, sharply distinguishing between Christ and the tenets of Christian theology, and criticizing its history as a, quote, hodgepodge of fallacy and violence. Goethe studied alchemy and was familiar with the esoteric aspects of religion in the context of energy transmutation. He was a Freemason, but one shouldn't assume that the masonry practiced by his Amalia Lodge called Rite of Strict Observance was the same as the masonry practiced today. The Rite of Strict Observance was a modification of Freemasonry based on the Order of the Knights Templar, divided into 7 degrees, and whose political and cultural ideology differed greatly from the modern far-leftist agenda which has taken hold of the West. The Knights Templar were closely tied to the Crusades, but when the Holy Land was lost, support for the order faded, and after King Philip IV of France had many Templars of the order arrested, tortured, and burned alive, Pope Clement V disbanded the order in 1312. The Knights Templar have become associated with legends concerning esoteric secrets and occult mysteries handed down to the select from ancient times. These initiation rituals and alchemical practices were forced to go underground, in many cases literally. One example of an underground cave system said to have been used by the Templars centuries ago is near Shifnal in Shropshire, UK. I hope I pronounced that right, where what appeared to be an ordinary rabbit hole on a farmer's property turned out to lead to an underground sanctuary, said to have been used by devotees of a medieval religious order, a grotto, which is reminiscent of the subterranean places of worship and ritual used by the followers of Mithras, an Aryan religion of ancient Iran and popular among many in the early part of the Roman Empire, which incidentally, like Freemasonry, has secret passwords, handshakes, and 7 levels of initiation, much like the Templar order that Goethe was a part of. That said, these caves in the UK were likely built no earlier than the 1600s, which is about 300 years after the Knights Templars were dissolved, so one could not definitively say that they literally belong to the Templars. So if there is an occult link in terms of ritual use, it was indirect. During the summer of 1998, cave explorers confirmed that a linked cave system, some 15 miles in length, runs underneath North Wales. German archaeologist Dr. Heinrich Kusch, in his book Secrets of the Underground, Door to the Ancient World, revealed that tunnels were dug under literally hundreds of Neolithic settlements all over Europe, and the fact that so many tunnels have survived 12,000 years indicates that the original network must have been engineered and constructed on a truly massive scale. Dr. Kusch compares these hidden or forgotten tunnels to ancient highways beneath the surface, and only a small fraction have been explored or documented. The discovery of a vast network of tunnels suggests that Stone Age humans were not just spending their days hunting and gathering, but the true actual purpose of the tunnels is still a matter of speculation. Some researchers believe that they were a form of protection from predators, while others believe that they were used to travel safely or possibly as shelter from harsh weather or even wars and violence. Since there's no conclusive answer as to how deep they go, some have even proposed that they may lead to vast, hollow caverns below the earth, subterranean chambers, which may have been the source to myths and legends about places like Agartha, Asgard, or Inner Earth. Dr. Cush insists that the empirical evidence of these Stone Age highways, as he calls them, has recently increased with the exploration of dozens of Neolithic settlements scattered from Scotland to Turkey, with most of these underground systems having been dated to the late Pleistocene, or the end of the last ice age. Dr. Henrik Cush says, in regards to the new evidence regarding the many miles of tunnels that he's investigated, and I quote, "Across Europe, there were thousands of them, from the north and Scotland down to the Mediterranean. And in some places, there's small rooms, storage chambers, and seating areas. They don't all link up, but taken together, it's a massive underground network. In Bavaria, in Germany alone, we have found 700 meters of these underground tunnel networks. In Syria and Austria, we found 350 meters across Europe. There are thousands of them, from the north in Scotland, down to the Mediterranean in Spain and North Africa, with others reported even in the Sahara. And some archaeologists believe the network was a way of protecting man from predators. Others maintain that they were periodic cataclysms from which Europeans took subterranean refuge. Still others believe that some of the link tunnels function as they do today. They allow for people to travel safely regardless of wars or violence or weather conditions on the surface. Dr. Heinrich Cush believes that the church often built these beautiful stone chapels by the entrances, perhaps because they were fearful by the heathen legacy that the tunnels might have represented, and they wanted to negate their influence. Or there could be another reason they did that. According to mythological traditions, underground sites were mostly referred to as entrances to the underworld. And we find such references all around the world. And although most of us think of the underworld as a representation of hell, and therefore an imaginary or spiritual place for bad people to go, but in reality, in ancient religions, that was not the case. And the underworld was a place where the dead did go, but it was a place with physical entrances, with guards, with buildings, with cities. And one of the most famous underground cities is the city of Agartha, a legendary subterranean empire that's supposed to be deep inside of the earth. And Central Asia is the likely origin of those legends. And it's said that they're still in contact through places such as Tibet, where the Dalai Lama lives, or lived. Theosophists refer to Agartha as a vast complex of caves and an underground network that was inhabited and largely man-made. In Greece, we have the myth of Hades and the underworld, a realm where gods and heroes lived. In the Mayan mythology, we have the mythical underground city of Xibalba, roughly translated as a place of fear, which was inhabited by superheroes and gods. And the civilization supposedly vanished around the Middle Ages. The entrance of this world was thought to be located somewhere in Guatemala, and a description of the structures and location within Xibalba are described in the Popol Vuh. The Hopi Indians maintained that their ancestors did not arrive from the north over a land bridge from Asia, nor do they believe that they arrived to the New World by boat, but instead, their origin myths tell the story of how they climbed onto the surface from the underworld. The specific location where the Hopi claim they emerged from took place in their legends deep inside the Grand Canyon, an enchanted opening from the mysterious recesses of the earth. Native American folklore states that the Grand Canyon was formed as a result of a great deluge which had drowned the previous third world. And Hopi cosmology specifies that this canyon was the exact place where the Hopi emerged from their subterranean refuge after a great flood had destroyed the previous age. There are several inner world entry points that are said to be located on their land in the canyon. One of them is very revered and honored in ceremony as the dwelling of an ancient parent race, and this sacred site is strictly off limits to all but the Hopi people themselves. In Irish legends, we read about the people named the Tuatha De Danann, people of the goddess Danu, a race who moved underground when another race arrived on the island, and those people in today's myths are often referred to as fairies, similar to the mystical population sets have existed in Maori legends on the islands of New Zealand. In Norwegian mythology, we have dwarves, beings of the underground associated with craftsmanship. Different races of dwarves were the ones that supplied the gods with weapons. In Egypt, we have references by the historian Herodotus of a colossal underground temple that contained 3,000 rooms full of paintings and hieroglyphs, and a massive labyrinth still lost and yet to be found. Many occult organizations, esoteric authors, and secret societies concur with these myths and legends of subterranean inhabitants who were the remnants of antediluvian civilizations which sought refuge in hollow caverns deep inside the earth, or may have originated below the surface, evolving there before coming above ground rather than coming down from the trees as is taught by modern academia. Edgar Allan Poe was an American writer and poet, best known for his tales of mystery, but also as a significant contributor to the emerging genre of science fiction. His 1844 poem called Dreamland begins by saying, quote, "By a route obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only, where an Eidolon named Night on a black throne reigns upright, I have reached these lands but newly, from an ultimate dim Thule, from a wild weird clime that lath sublime, out of space, out of time." It is interesting to note that Poe described an ultimate dim Thule, as in dimly lit. Isidore de Seville was a Spanish scholar and cleric. For over three decades, he was Archbishop of Seville and widely regarded as the last scholar of the ancient world. In the early 7th century, he wrote in his Etymologies, quote, "Ultima Thule is an island of the ocean in the northwestern region beyond Britannia, taking its name from the sun, because there the sun makes its summer solstice, and there is no daylight beyond this. Hence, its sea is sluggish and frozen." Isidore distinguished this from the islands of Britannia and Ireland, which he called Scotia, a name which I covered in a prior video and will leave a link in the description. By the late Middle Ages, scholars were linking Iceland or Greenland to the name Thule and other distant or mythical locations, such as High Brazil, which I also covered in a prior video and will leave a link in the description. A Byzantine Greek scholar, Eustathius of Thessalonica, in his 12th century commentary on the Iliad, wrote that the inhabitants of Thule were at war with a tribe whose dwarf-like members were only 20 fingers in height. Of course, I also covered this ancient, well-documented Pygmy War as well, and bring it up now only to point out that the alleged location of the mythical Thule was not agreed upon except to say that it was somewhere in the far north. While it is most commonly referred to as an island, in classical and medieval literature, Ultima Thule acquired a metaphorical meaning of any distant place located beyond the borders of the known world, or the world's unexplored uppermost reaches. That said, in 1818, John Cleve Sims Jr., an American army officer, suggested that the Earth's interior could be accessed through holes at the North and South Poles. In 1885, William Fairfield Warren argued in his book, Paradise Found, The Cradle of the Human Race at the North Pole, that humanity had descended from a place called Hyperborea in the far north. The father of the Indian independence movement, Bal Gangadhar Tilak, who even appears on his own stamp, claimed that after the destruction of their original Arctic home, survivors roamed the northern parts of Europe and Asia in search of land suitable for new settlements, eventually migrating to India and that the ancestors of India's ancient Vedic civilization once lived in the Arctic region. In 1903, Tilak wrote the book, The Arctic Home in the Vedas. In it, he argued that the Vedas could only have been composed in the Arctics, and the Aryan bards brought them south after the onset of the last ice age. In 1908, a book was published called The Smoky God, or A Voyage Journey to the Inner Earth, which I previously covered, and was a book presented as a true account describing the adventures of Olaf Jensen, a Norwegian sailor who sailed with his father through an entrance to the Earth's interior at the North Pole. I also covered a book called Edda Dorfa, published in 1895, which also explored the notion of vast inhabited caverns, dimly lit by glowing fungus, that existed below our feet. Geoffrey of Monmouth was a British cleric and one of the major figures in the development of British historiography and the popularity of tales of King Arthur. He described Ultima Thule as experiencing, quote, an eternal spring, green throughout seasons. The German Thule Society, an occultist order that was founded in Munich shortly after World War I, did not necessarily hold fast to the notion that a green and perpetually spring-like land had ever existed at the North Pole, but rather, they thought, perhaps, it could have existed beneath it. And so, throughout their literature can be seen references to concepts pertaining to inner earth. This notion of the original myths and legends about Thule being a subterranean land, accessible through either of the polar regions, whether as an island or not, is mirrored in the theories and behavior of the National Socialists, who not only had top secret maps that were leaked to the public after the fall of the Soviet Union of vast, habitable, or inhabited lands inside of the Earth, which they allegedly were able to reach through the use of their U-boats, or submarines, but actually built bases below the ice at the entrance to these underground kingdoms, which the Allied forces, under the command of Admiral Byrd, unsuccessfully attacked in 1946 and 47 in a still classified military invasion of Antarctica called Operation High Jump. Vril, The Power of the Coming Race, was a novel by Edward Bulwer Lytton, published in 1871, about a psychically and technologically advanced subterranean race that utilized a universal energy called Vril, which can be equated to Chi or Ki in the East and Prana in India. Some authors, notably Helena Blavatsky, William Scott Elliot, and Rudolf Steiner, accepted the book as based in part on occult truth, as did occult secret societies in Germany, most notably the Vril Society, which conducted research into psychic and metaphysical phenomena, as well as free energy technology. The novel centers around a young, independent, unnamed, wealthy traveler who visits his friend, who's a mining engineer. They explore a mine together, and the narrator reaches the bottom of the chasm safely, but the rope breaks and his friend is killed. The narrator finds his way to a subterranean world occupied by beings who seem to resemble angels. He befriends the first being he meets, who guides him around a city that is reminiscent of ancient Egyptian architecture. The hero discovers that these beings, who call themselves Vrilia, have great telepathic and other parapsychological abilities, such as being able to transmit information, get rid of pain, and put others to sleep. The narrator soon discovers that the Vrilia are descendants of an antediluvian civilization who live in networks of caverns linked by tunnels. Originally surface dwellers, they fled underground thousands of years ago to escape a massive flood and gained greater power by facing and dominating the harsh conditions of the earth. Their society is a technologically supported utopia, chief among their tools being an all-permeating fluid called Vril, a latent source of energy that the spiritually elevated hosts are able to master through training of their will to a degree that depends on their hereditary genetic constitution. This mastery gives them access to extraordinary force that can be controlled at will, which includes the ability to heal and cure, but also to destroy. Its light is said to be steadier, softer, and healthier than that from any flammable material. Vril can also be used as a power source for animating mechanisms and can be harnessed and transmuted, then controlled by mental concentration. Helena Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy, endorsed the concept of Vril in her book Isis Unveiled in 1877 and again in The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. When William Scott Elliot described life in Atlantis in The Story of Atlantis and the Lost Lemuria, published in 1896, the aircraft of the Atlanteans were propelled by Vril force. Which brings us back to Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who knew of the Gnostic esoteric secrets of the ancient orders, which was brought back into Europe by the Knights Templar, that centered around harnessing Vril, transmuting raw energetic impulses of lust, which is the driving force behind procreation, and refining the bio-electromagnetic life force energy into love, which is a more pure and subtle form of the same energy, which can then manifest as compassion, creativity, and other artistic and altruistic expressions, as demonstrated by Goethe, whether it be in the form of literature, poetry, inventions, or in ways other influential masters of energetic transmutation contributed to society in their own unique way, such as Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Sir Isaac Newton, Beethoven, Socrates, Pythagoras, Plato, and Nikola Tesla. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.